Drawing room over here.
Oh, hey, come on in. The Roxy was a home to the bands that defined punk in the UK. The Sex Pistols, The Clash, The Buzzcocks. It was also the home to Don Letts. As the venue's resident DJ, he documented the scene in his film The Punk Rock Movie and played a role in introducing reggae to the London punk scene. Don's gone on to be an award-winning documentary maker, an acclaimed DJ, and the co-founder of the band Big Audio Dynamite. He's in Australia for Perth's Wham Fest, and he's my guest in the drawing room. Don, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
You've said that punk made you realise that you didn't want to just be a fan. What do you mean? What did that mean to you at the time? Did it suddenly seem possible to be part of something?
I think that was the most interesting thing about punk rock. It kind of said to the audience, hey, if you're brave enough and if you've got a good idea, you can be part of this thing too.
So what was that thing that you became part of?
It was a countercultural movement. It kind of created a ground zero whereby if you had an idea, you could express yourself through what I think was punk rock's greatest gift, which was the whole idea of DIY, do it yourself. You know, there was a lot of reinvention going on during that time. I mean, it's often said that when The Clash or The Pistols played, the next day hundreds of bands would form, which was partially true. But a lot of people would walk away from those gigs inspired, and it would inform whatever they did. So you had punk rock poets, fashion designers, graphic artists, photographers, journalists, and filmmakers. And I think that's one of the reasons that we're still speaking about it today, is that it wasn't just a soundtrack. It was a complete subculture.
So how did you end up as the house DJ for the Roxy?
Let me try and put that shortly. I was running a shop on the Kings Road, Chelsea, called Acme Attractions. Back in those days, we're talking about mid-70s, there was two hip shops on the Kings Road, my shop and a shop being run by Malcolm McLaren and Vivian Westwood called Sex. And the sort of disaffected white youth would be walking in between these two shops looking for something to do, but I had more people in my shop because I played hardcore dub reggae. In the midst of all this, the whole punk rock thing's exploding. They've got a look, they've got an attitude, but because of the negative press, they had no place to play. A friend of mine called Andrew Chakowski decided to open the very first live punk rock venue, the Roxy. Because of the reaction he saw to the music I played in the shop, he asked me to have a go DJing there. Never DJed in my life. I had no aspirations of doing that.
You've been DJing in your shop, kind of.
Well, not really. I was just playing music that I liked. You know what I mean? So anyway, I get the gig to DJ at the Roxy. Now, this is so early in the movement, there are no punk records to play. So what's a guy to do? I play something I like, which is this hardcore dub reggae. Lucky for me, the white kids liked it too. I guess they loved the obvious anti-establishment vibe. They liked the fact that the lyrics had a kind of musical reportage quality about them. They loved the bass lines, and they didn't mind the weed either. So there was some serious cultural exchange going on at the Roxy. Let's put it that way.
You said there were two cool stores in town or on the street.
Yep.
Was there a bit of competition between you and McLaren and Westwood? Were you friends? What was the deal there?
I was good friends with both Vivian and Malcolm before the whole punk thing exploded. In fact, I think meeting McLaren was probably one of the most fortuitous moments of my life, because before punk exploded, he was the one that kind of showed me that, you know, these sort of subcultural, countercultural things that I was so enamored with didn't happen in isolation. They had a heritage. They had a tradition. And again, he was the one that pointed out to me that, you know, you guess what? You can be part of this thing too. You don't have to be a spectator or just a fan. And that's what's important about punk as well, is that it broke down that fourth wall that said, you know, we're the band, we're the stars, and you're the audience, and that's how it would be forever. You know, it broke that wall down. And it was very much all-inclusive. I mean, that's why there were so many women involved. I mean, at the top of this spot, you rolled off a bunch of male names, but there was just as many important women as well. You know, the Slits, Susie and the Banshees, X-Ray Specs, that empowered women, not only up and down the UK, but around the globe, man.
How did reggae become your music?
How did reggae? I'm a black man. It's in my DNA. Seriously. It's, you know, it's funny, you know, in Western culture, you know, popular music is quite often associated with something that young people do. But for a lot of people of colour, it's inherent to our culture. Mm. You know, kids are doing it. Your parents are doing it. Your grandparents are doing it. And it's a way we communicate. It's the way we inform people about our history. It's very much a tool for social change and expression.
What was it like being a black man in Britain in the punk scene? You talked about the positive roles for women, but was the same kind of equal approach there for people of colour?
Well, put it this way, not a lot of brothers were enamoured with punk. They thought it was kind of noisy rubbish.
Yeah, they did.
I was never happy being defined by my colour. And for whatever reason, it just spoke to me. You know, I think musically, you know, the difference between reggae and punk, you know, they're miles apart. But where we connect is in our spirit. You know, we were like-minded rebels. We were all outsiders. And that's where we met.
So this outsider thing, what was it like being in that kind of scene? Because the vision I have is that British punk is very white. Did you feel like an outsider?
It was very white. It was, you know, white people doing their thing. But, you know, people have to understand, listen, punk rock's not about mohawks. It's not about safety pins. It's about an attitude and a spirit that can inform whatever you do. So, for instance, the birth of reggae music, Jamaican music, that was a punk rock moment. You know, the guys couldn't do all the fancy Eric Clapton stuff. They could hold down a chord and transpose it. And they made what would be a problem into an asset. That's very much a punk rock thing. The birth of hip hop in America is a punk rock moment. I'd argue that the birth of rock and roll was a punk rock moment. What happens to these things is the underground eventually becomes the overground, and the young people have to kind of reclaim it again. I'm a great believer that every generation needs its own soundtrack. And in the mid-70s, my white mates never had one. You know, we had all this sort of prog rock thing going on with bands playing 10-minute guitar solos and drum solos and people singing about Hotel California. We didn't know where California was, much less being able to afford a hotel. So, you know, my white mates set about creating a soundtrack that was of the people, for the people, by the people, and that was punk rock.
Is that spirit of DIY and that counterculture still there in punk now, or has it travelled off to places like hip-hop?
I think the ideas that were given to us by punk have informed a lot of things these days. And again, I'm not talking about mohawks and safety pins. I'm talking about an approach to doing whatever you do. I mean, you know, I think you can be a punk rock teacher. I think you can be a punk rock doctor. In fact, I'd say we probably need more of them than bands. You know, the stage is kind of full up. But it is, you know, it's not, people have to understand that it is this spirit, this attitude that's actually bigger than music, you know, and it can inform whatever you do. And the other thing that's important is I think people have to understand that it's not something to look back on. It's actually something to look forward to. It's the birthright of all young people, man.
On RN, I'm Patricia Carvelis and Don Letts is my guest in the drawing room. He's the host of Culture Clash Radio on BBC Six and an acclaimed musician. Your parents were part of...
You're forgetting filmmaker.
And filmmaker and genuine, real international legend. Is that good?
Well, I'm working on the legend part. That's a work in progress.
I'm just going just in case, just to cover myself off.
But my main trade is actually filmmaking. And the thing is, there's big gaps in between making films. You're not making films every week. So to supplement my meagre filmmaker income, I do other things like the radio show. I DJ nationally and internationally. And I've just entered the world of podcasts as well.
Of course you have. Podcasts, it's their moment now, right?
Apparently, yeah.
Yeah, apparently. Hey, let's go to your filmmaking because, you know, you mentioned it. It must mean that it's your favourite of your identities. Am I right?
Yeah. Putting pictures and music together, yeah. I mean, I saw a film when I was 19, when I was, 14, called Harder They Come, Jamaica's most famous film. And I was totally struck by the power of film to entertain, inspire, and inform, and sort of dreamed about being a filmmaker myself one day. And which was a ridiculous idea for a young black man in the early 70s because it was very much an old white boys network. Mm-hmm. And then punk came along 5 years later with the whole DIY thing. I'm looking around, all my mates are picking up guitars. I wanted to pick up something too. So I picked up a Super 8 camera and reinvented myself as Don Letts, the filmmaker.
A reinvention that's been quite successful. Hey, your parents were part of the Windrush generation.
Yeah.
What do you make of the recent Windrush scandal in the UK, the deportation of children from that generation?
I'm trying to think of a non-four-letter word that will sum up how I felt about it. It was
keeping it clean for the radio.
Yeah, exactly. No, listen, it was obviously a scandal, man. I mean, listen, people don't understand that the people that came over in the 50s were asked to come. They were asked to come by the then Minister of Health, who was a politician called Enoch Powell. And they were asked to come to help rebuild the country after the Second World War. 10 years later, he has a serious change of heart and delivers this speech called the Rivers of Blood speech, which totally polarized the landscape and saw a rise of the National Front, a right-wing party in the UK. So, what's interesting is, they invite my parents over to help rebuild the country. And then, much as they're doing today, the politicians played on the fears of the old white folk and blaming the ills of the country on the immigrants, who they'd asked to come, by the way. But what's interesting, on the other side of that coin, at street level, the music of my parents and of Jamaica had captured the imagination of white working class kids. So while the politicians are driving the old people apart, the music was bringing the kids black and white together, in the schools, on the streets and in the playgrounds. So Jamaican music really acted as a tool for social change, to unite the people. Because I'm a great believer that, that's the purpose of culture, to bring people together through understanding our differences, not by trying to be the same.
You were one of the founders of the band Big Audio Dynamite. Could you play an instrument at the time?
Nope, and that's why I was a member of the band. Mick got me to join the band because I had no musical ability whatsoever. So my ideas came from other places, because I couldn't pick up a guitar. And one of the big things about BAD, we were the first band to have serious commercial hits by using samples and dialogue, which was all down to me. Because while the guys were in the studio laying down the tracks, I wanted to contribute as well. So I'm nicking 6-minute chunks from films like Sergio Leone's Good, the Bad and the Ugly and shed loads of other films. But eventually I realized that you don't get paid for that because what I was doing was effectively stealing other people's stuff. And threw myself into lyric writing with Mick Jones's guidance, it has to be said, and ended up co-writing 50% of Big Audio Dynamite songs. The first song I ever wrote was Equals MC Squared, our first hit. Orson Welles, Orson Welles is, right?
I certainly do, yeah.
Okay, he once famously said, if you want to make an original film, don't watch movies. And that's why Mick Jones got me in BAD, if you can dig what I'm getting at.
I do. So the idea is, start from scratch, don't be derivative, don't even look.
Absolutely, because everyone else is kind of reading the same book.
Yeah, and then thinking, well, this is the thing, isn't it? It's the way we kind of, it's the sheep mentality. You think that's the way it's meant to be made, so I'm going to make it like that.
Well, kind of. I mean, the thing is, we have to understand very little on the planet Earth comes out of a void. But the point is that, everybody's inspired by something, but you have to do your own thing with it. It's about self-interpretation, not just as slavishly copying something. That doesn't do anybody any good. But you've got to try and push things forward and put yourself in the mix.
So what makes good music for film?
Oh, man. How do I know? I don't know. That's
thought you might have a hunch.
Objective. I mean, I can tell you what I think does that. It usually starts with a good bass line. But, different strokes for different folks, man. There's stuff that works beautifully that I can't stand. But, I'll tell you who I do love that's good at putting music and picture together is Baz Luhrmann. I love what he does. Absolutely love that brother. And then somebody like Martin Scorsese, he's good at putting music and film together. But, these guys are, they're passionate about music. They love it,
You're pretty passionate about music too, so much so that you're the host of a radio show on the BBC these days. What's catching your attention? What's the song or the band or the something that we should all be listening to?
Man, again, that's another hard one. I mean, you'd have to listen to my show. I tell you why, because I tell you what's interesting in the 21st century, because everyone's got such a short attention span, there's very few complete bodies of work, i.e. albums. There's loads and loads of singles, but very few complete albums. I mean, somebody I'm digging right now personally is a guy called Father John Misty, for instance. I don't know if you people know him over here, but he's pretty consistent. I love Arcade Fire. Mm. And then after that, it would be hard for me to think of albums. There's a group called the Sons of Kemet that I love. Kamasi Washington's kind of interesting. and so on and forth, so forth. But for the most part, it's one-off singles.
Hey, Don, you've been such a delight to talk to. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for the airtime.
Don Letts there. He's been my guest in the drawing room. He's the host of Culture Clash Radio on BBC Six. And of course, as he says, he's a filmmaker and he's the keynote speaker at WhamFest in Perth this week.